Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hola, mi amiga.
You totally caught me off guard.
Yo soy Dr. Deborah.
Oh my God, you're so crazy.
¿Cómo está?
Would you sniff a line before we came in here?
I just felt like being funny.
Oh my God.
It's almost your birthday.
Oh my God, I'm dying.
A week and a half.
Well, listen to this.
Yes.
This is how my week started. I'm an idiot. I put diesel gasoline in my car. But no, this isn't the first time. I did this once before in 1998
Holy
in college.
Crap.
So now I've done it once again. I had to get the car towed. It's still like they're still working on it because it's a hybrid.
Oh no.
I think it's totally fucked. I think we're at least $2,000 in. Yeah.
Kelly.
But you know what? It was a really expensive lesson on mindfulness for me. Because do you know why it was happening? I was on the phone. I was doing like 8 things.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, oh, yeah, I need gas. I'll just put it in. And then like...
I clicked the wrong button.
But I didn't just like... I feel like they should make it like really obvious. Like, diesel, make sure. You know, but it's just like... So anyway, I put the whole thing in.
Oh, a whole tank.
A whole entire tank. And then my car wouldn't start. And that's how I was like, Yeah, so that's how my week started.
Diesel dudes?
Yeah. David's like, you fill my heart with love and diesel. Like, it was.
Oh, my God. Oh, Kelly.
So that's how my week started. However, it did end sort of really cool. I got a psychic reading.
Oh,
you know, I'm obsessed with that crap. Very interesting. Very interesting. So that was kind of cool. And then I went to an amazing spiritual meditation group. That was incredible. A lot of therapists. So it was a good way to wind down my crazy beginning of the week.
Oh, my goodness.
No.
You know, I feel bad for you, but it is a good lesson.
Yes.
The most idiotic thing I've ever done at a gas station was drive off with the thing still in the... It was like such an idiot because the person's like screaming at me, hey, hey, hey. And I'm like, la, 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 la.
Yes.
Oops. Then you hear this noise.
I totally get it.
That was not that expensive, though. I think it was $160 because it snaps off.
Oh.
I didn't, like, rip apart the whole
thing.
Gassing.
Yes.
It's like part of it just snaps off. So
I can't believe I've never done that. It seems like something I would do.
Seems like something that most people would have done at some point, right? Because of all of our distractions.
Have you ever put diesel in? Because I think
I've
it's more...
I've never done that.
Yeah, see, I don't understand. That to me seems so much more common because it's just like, they're right next to each other.
But usually they're at a separate pump,
this
right?
One wasn't. It was that Arco gas station that I hate because you have to use like a credit card or debit, whatever the hell it was. So here I am. First I put my credit card in. That doesn't work. Like, oh, I need a debit card. So I put the debit card. So I was just all over the place. But yeah, they're in the same section. I know.
Oh,
ridiculous. So
all right. Well,
anyway, that's my
story.
You're
lucky that you have such a kind-hearted husband because he didn't beat you up. He didn't shame you. He didn't attack you.
Well, he wasn't happy.
I don't blame him for not being happy, but at least he understands that people make mistakes.
You're much kinder. I wish you were my husband. Put it that way. Tell me about your week.
My week. You know, I'm a little bit slow in practice this week, which is okay. You know, sometimes
good.
It's good. It allows me to have a little freedom to do some other things that I want to take care of. And I'm really trying to kind of navigate my wishes for my next 30, 40 years, you know, what that's really going to look like. It's a really pretty big transformational highlight in my life that I'm just not certain, you know, what that's going to look like. But, you know, had a good conversation with my financial advisor and said things are on track. And
oh, good.
So I feel some sense of comfort about that. I bought my first cryptocurrency today.
Wait, what's cryptocurrency?
Bitcoin. No, you haven't heard of it.
No. What is this?
It's a whole other life. I'll educate you about it later.
Oh my God, interesting. Sounds
Kelly,
so like
where are you?
I don't know. I'm apparently in another world.
There's one other person, one of my doctor clients, and I mentioned it to, and he goes, what's that? I'm like, it's startling to you. I'm usually the last one on the bandwagon to understand these things, but it's, you know, it's a whole new wave of, it's like the wave of the future about what our money system
really?
Is going to look like.
Okay. I'm interested to hear.
All right. Cool. So other than that, just had some fun, had some friends over, did some improv? Have you ever done any acting improv yet? Of course you have, because you've done acting. Yeah, that was fun. Actually, with Tiffany's dad, we went over there.
No, was it like charades?
No, he was a former actor, so he actually gave us a little bit part of what we were supposed
to
play.
So cute.
Like, I was like an English, I was like a nun or something, and Christopher was a salesperson. And, you know, you can't tell each other who you are, and you have to go with it. You're not supposed to negate what the other person's doing. So it was just hysterical.
That's fun.
It really breaks you out of your own shell, you know, different characters, different roles. It was fun. And then we had some friends over for dinner, and we turned on the music, and we danced, and we just had a really good time.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. It's nice not having children at home.
It's so beautiful.
We have, like, different lives.
Oh, my God. That's like a world on its own right now to me. Like, that's just so, that fantasy world. I'll get there at some point.
Yes, you will.
Yes. You paid your dues.
I did. I did. I know. I think you're paying more dues than I ever paid.
I'm broke. I'm in debt. Bankruptcy.
You're in mommy debt.
Yes.
Well, but that's good that you go fill yourself up sometimes.
Yes.
You do workshops, you do these different things, and that's awesome. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. So last week we had Dr. Sherry Steins, who talked to us about narcissism and antisocial personality disorder, borderline personality disorder. It was really fascinating. I liked how her definition and description of personality disorders, and how, you know, the more we understand, the less frustrated we will be with people we encounter in our lives who have those. But, you know, when you're in an intimate relationship with somebody who suffers from a character disorder or personality disorder, it's a challenge.
My God, I loved what she said. She was like, at first when I heard the word narcissism or I met somebody, I was like, he's just an asshole, you know? And then she's like, and then you realize that they have a real legitimate issue and problem. So it's a good way to look at that.
And reminder, personality disorder does not mean you have a bad personality. It just means that you are rigidly stuck in your ways of certain
elements. It could be both.
How you perceive the world, you know? And it affects your social life, your occupational life, your intimate life. And it frustrates the crap out of other people.
Yeah, it really does.
Okay, but today we have an amazing guest as well. His name is Ira Israel, the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult. So needed. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
A licensed marriage and family therapist and professional clinical counselor, Ira graduated from the University of Pennsylvania and holds advanced degrees in psychology, philosophy, and religious studies. His DVD series, including A Beginner's Guide to Happiness and Mindfulness for Depression, along with his sold-out Esalen workshops, have given him a wide international following. He lives in Santa Monica, California, and here he is to join us on the show today. Hello!
Ira, you there? Oh, no.
Uh-oh. Well,
this was kind of funny because we had called
you. No, I'm here.
Oh,
I'm
good.
Here, I'm here. It's so funny. I'm here.
Has your
it's a pleasure to be with you guys today.
Has the lovely police officer left the scene?
No. It's all good.
Okay.
All right. Great. Did you get a ticket?
He's like, I don't want to talk about it.
Nope. Didn't get a ticket.
Okay. Good.
Awesome.
It's all good. Everything is under control.
Okay. So I love the title of your book, and I know like thousands of people who need to read that because people hang on to their childhood and live in this victim mentality that is so tragic both for them and everybody around them. So what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I noticed the epidemic proportions of depression and anxiety in our culture. So I wanted to take a look at the underlying foundations of our society. And, you know, as I say in the book, I don't think there's a rogue gene that's causing 23 million Americans to take antidepressants every day. Let's take a look at capitalism or romantic love or how hard we work or can we live balanced lives in this hyper-competitive society and everyone's trying to keep up with the Joneses. Like, what are the things that are stressing people out? And then what are the things that are causing depression? So I really hope that I raise consciousness in the book and get people to ask, maybe I can tweak some things in my life as opposed to, you know, getting on medication.
And I know that you have a super fascinating and interesting story. And I was wondering if you could share that with our listeners.
32 years ago last Sunday, I was badly hurt in a car accident. And I went on a journey that I didn't know I was going on. And for 8 years after that, I studied philosophy. What's the meaning of life? Who am I? And I lived in Paris for 3 years, and I lived in Manhattan. And I got really interested in film and literature and music and dance, and just wanted to figure out like how the world was operating and what all these artists and musicians and writers were saying. And then in 94, I got hurt in Thailand, and a woman healed me with her hand, which totally blew open everything I'd been studying for those past 8 years, because there was like this other paradigm, which was essentially, you know, the things that we consider to be paranormal in our culture are normal in societies that espouse Buddhism and Hinduism, things like that. So for 8 years, I studied spirituality, yoga, meditation, you know, spent time in ashrams in India and things like that. And then I was back in the States, and I got into a very dysfunctional relationship. And then I started studying psychology for about 8 years. And so the fascinating thing to me is that if you looked at my life after the University of Pennsylvania, you would just say, oh, you know, he's lost. Like, what is he doing living in Paris, sitting in cafes, reading Sartre? Mm-hmm. What is he doing in India, sitting in the ashrams, meditating at 4 a.m? What is he doing? You know, like, and then all of a sudden, after 25 years of meandering, literally a woman came into my, I was teaching at Rodney Yee's yoga studio in Piedmont. And a woman came in and put her hands down on the mat, and I literally, like, this might sound a little kooky, like, I heard a voice, and the voice just said, it's time to give back. You've been indulgent for 25 years, and now all the stuff that you've aggregated in your studies of philosophy, spirituality, and psychology, you have to teach. And so I made those 5 DVDs, Mindfulness for Depression, Mindfulness for Anxiety, and I've been teaching at Esalen, and now I have the book out. So I really feel like I'm, it, you know, as opposed to the meandering for 25 years, you know, I would just prefer to think of myself as somewhat of a late bloomer. Mm-hmm. And I had to, you know, figure out all those questions that, you know, tragedy or severe trauma puts, you know, into play, you know, those like, what, you know, why are people so depressed? Why is the world such a weird place? You know, like, why don't relationships work out better? Why do people have to work so hard and struggle? And what's the cause of all this suffering? So those are all the questions I address in the book.
But what a wealth of experience you developed in that meandering and floundering. I think you'd be the envy of many people who did that fixated path. It's like you go to college, you get into your career, you just stay focused, and then what shit do you know anyway?
Nothing.
Nothing.
You're like the male version of Eat, Pray, Love. You're the male version. Have you read that book?
Well, you know what? Yeah, of course. And I, you know, but when I teach at Esalen, I always show her TED Talk, which I think is literally, I'm going to say something pretty stupid right now. It is the single greatest thing on the internet is Elizabeth Gilbert's TED Talk. It's the most inspiring thing, because it puts into question our whole paradigm. And, you know, the way we've anthropomorphized genius, and where it used to be just a muse, and you would have this relationship with the some ways, and you know, during the Enlightenment we threw the baby out with the bathwater, and now we have this thing that we believe in. Nietzsche wrote 125 years ago how our faith in God will become a faith in science. And yet, as I say in the book, you know, Thomas Kuhn in 1968 writes that paradigm shift every 25 years. You know, we believe the earth was flat, we believe in a lot of weird things that in 30 or 40 or 100 years they're going to look back on us like we're cavemen. I mean, people look back on, we're going to look back on root canals like we look back on leaching or burning witches.
Yeah, right.
So true.
Wow, so true. Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. You have a fascinating chapter in your book that I'd love to dive more deeply into, the myth of romance, because this is such a hot topic in you know, psychotherapy. When people come in, I mean, Kelly and I both do a lot of relationship counseling and couples counseling, and I just remember there was a book title a long time ago called Cinderella Was a Liar, and I attached to that like flies on shit. It was like, oh my God, it was so true. All the stuff that we are taught that's so bogus growing up. So tell us more about that chapter and what you know your premise and all that.
Well, my entryway was a book called We by Robert Johnson, which depends heavily on Denis de Rougemont's book L'amour et l'Occident, Love in the Western World. And basically both of these theorists say that romantic love as we know it is esoteric to Western culture. It's about 700 years old, and it's based on the myths of Tristan and Isolde. And in that myth, in knightly love, the knights protected the damsels in distress, the maidens, and they was never consummated. But starting with that myth, Tristan is sent over to get Isolde, who's already betrothed to his uncle, and he's supposed to get her and bring her back. And then the Brunhild gives them this secret love potion, and depending on which version of the myth you read, they have unbridled lust for each other for either 3 months or 3 years. And I think that's fascinating because in our culture, marriages last about 7 years on average, but you find that like the lust or the sex dies after a certain amount of time. Esther Perel brilliantly says, how can you want what you already have? How can you desire what you already have? Right. Mm-hmm. So we take this myth and, the extreme version of it, everybody knows, which is we're basically unwhole. You know, pop culture informs us that we're unwhole, and the missing part of us is the panacea. And they're going to make us feel whole, and we'll never be worried again, and things like that. And that's best. Everyone's seen this in the movie Jerry Maguire, mm-hmm. where they're in the elevator, and Tom Cruise says, "You complete me." And I always say in my classes, "Well, if that's the case, then he's really fucked because she's not always going to be there, right? Mm-hmm. Like she's not. So if somebody else completes you, if you don't complete yourself, then it's a serious problem." And that's mm-hmm. what the myth of romantic love teaches us, that we're on whole and that when we meet our soulmate, everything will be okay. And, relationships don't work out like that. So the problem is that we're the first culture that gets married for basically lust. We call mm-hmm. it chemistry, mm-hmm. but it's sexual chemistry, things like that. But for the greater part of humanity, everyone gets married for financial reasons. Like my father would have go in a carrot farm, and the girls next door's father would have two rabbits and a sheep, and the fathers would get together and say, "I think it's a good idea if our kids got married," and we would get married. And arranged marriages have a just as good a success rate as what we're doing in our culture, which is depending upon lust and the desire to want to have sex with the other person to make a functional relationship. And I actually go one step further, and I think I write this in the book, and I say that it's distinctly possible that passion correlates with dysfunctionality. So, I've noticed with my patients and in my personal life that there's relationships. I should have asked before. Can I swear on your show?
Absolutely. Yes.
Didn't you hear? It's already set the stage. I said shit twice.
So I've noticed that there's one part. There's a certain percentage of relationships that are, very dramatic, and those are the relationships of fucking and fighting. And, we have this great chemistry, but then afterwards, he gets very jealous or, and this happens and that happens and, they can't work it out. And what I'm really interested in studying are power dynamics. And that's the whole thing that we can also talk about, which is the Harvey Weinstein and today Aziz Ansari and all the things that are coming out in our culture with disproportional or hierarchical power dynamics between men and women, which, I don't know what the future of dating is. All I know is that when guys are in my office, I'm just like, dude, err on the side of caution. Like if someone says to me, is asking a woman out twice sexual harassment right now? The answer is fucking yes. you got to be really, we're living in really, really confusing times. And, as I said, for people like me and other people, you always have to be so compassionate and loving and just err on the side of caution.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I know.
Have you ever been sexually harassed?
Yeah.
Kelly?
Yeah,
uh-huh. I have too. It's an awful experience, but I certainly wouldn't experience if somebody asked me out twice as being sexual harassment.
I know. And I do feel bad for the good guys out there because
they're just trying to be persistent and increase confidence and be able to. I mean, I think there's a style in which people demonstrate harassment just somebody trying to be confident and say, oh, come on, you might have a good time,
I think we have an awesome model to rectify the situation in the psychotherapy community because, Kelly and I, we signed these contracts with the VBS that said these licensures, and they say you know, you, if anybody comes into your office for any reason, no matter what, and they're, that you have that patient-therapist relationship, you have to wait 2 years until you stop seeing them to date them or be friends with them or have any type of dual relationship. So I actually think that that model should be applied in the post office and throughout Hollywood. And I've written to Anita Hill and the people on the board for against sexual harassment, that's the committee that's been formed, because I really think that we have a great model in our society to create a safe work environment. And it's in the psychotherapy community, and we should just take that model and apply it throughout America for an undetermined amount of time until we realize, I mean, in where I grew up, there's a phrase, I'm sure you guys know it too, like, don't shit where you eat.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just, if someone, if you're working with someone, don't fucking date them.
But let me ask you this, because you were talking about passion correlates with dysfunction and things like that. Like, will that make it even more appealing for people? It's like, we definitely cannot do this. This is taboo. We're not allowed. And that,
that's a whole other chapter in the book. That's an entire other chapter in the book where I say that when things are when there are interdicts laid out, that does make things more enticing. But but the priority right now should not be some deep psychological thing that that I'm discussing, because this is all theoretical. It should be, let's create a safe workplace for everybody as quickly as possible.
Sure.
Right. Now, do you have the same hard line for people who work together who are on the same level, but they're nobody's in charge of the other person?
This is a fascinating thing. So this is my counter argument that I would talk about regarding dysfunctionality. So if you notice, maybe you've already done it. Let's say one of you knows a eligible single person and the other one knows an eligible single person. It could be male, female, male, whatever it is. So they say you slide their resumes across the desk and they both make $130,000 a year. They both went to UCLA. They both like ping pong, surfing, and yoga, and they're both vegetarian. And they go out on a date, and what I suspect you would hear is, you know, he's amazing, he's wonderful, there was just no chemistry. And that's what's really interesting to me. So basically, in the book, I quote Harville Hendrix, who says that the subconscious purpose of marriage in America is to enable us to complete our childhood. Mm-hmm. Our parents had deficits. Those deficits wounded us. Those wounds became defense mechanisms, and those defense mechanisms became our personalities. And we'll always be attracted to people who can replicate the dynamics of one or more of our primary caregivers. And then I was with Marianne Williamson about two months ago, and she said, and if your partner can't replicate the dynamics for one or more of your primary caregivers, you'll train them to. So that's why I'm so interested in attachment theory, because we have these theories of reality and we have these imprints of relationships and these patterns in our heads, whatever we saw growing up. If your parents fought all the time, but they stay together, then you have this imprint in your head that fighting equals love.
Sure.
So like, this whole book is about authenticity and figuring out a way, which is atonement, which is another chapter in the book, where, you know, accepting your past, forgiving everybody, and deciding who you want to be, rather than letting all those influences from when you were, you know, 2 weeks old or 6 months old or 7 years old or 14 years old to make your decision today.
We are talking with Ira Israel. This is fantastic. He wrote the book, How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult. Oh my God, I have so much to say. I mean, I'm just like...
Well, so let's talk a little bit about then the role of passion, lust, sex. And I mean, most people, the idea of, oh, a healthy relationship is going to be asexual probably isn't going to be very appealing to most people. So what is the role of healthy sexuality in a couple with a functional relationship?
Well, for me, and I make a joke about this all the time, I say marriage for life was a fantastic idea in the 13th century when the average lifespan was 28. But now that we're living until 87 years old, marriage for life is a pretty stupid idea. We should have renewable marriage contracts, and then there should be a clause in there. If you have a child, then you're on the hook for 18 years. So for me, you know, passion is our way of bonding. You know, it's just that's what I think. It's our way of bonding. I mean, it's really interesting. If you look at the animal kingdom and if you look at sodomy or, you know, oral sex or anything in the animal kingdom, and then you look at human beings and you go on the internet, I mean, I say in the book, I say, the aliens came down from another planet and typed the word sex into Google, they would think that we were really confused. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we do a lot of stuff that is like, when you watch pornography, this is in the book too, when you watch pornography, you don't sit there and think, oh, that's so sweet, they really love each other. I mean, they're spraying each other, it's very athletic, it's not a loving thing. So mm-hmm. for me, the whole thing is, you have to decide your relationship with your own sexuality, and then you have to grow, you have to evolve, you have to be curious, you have to find a partner that has the same repressions as you, because they're going to find the same things titillating in some ways. Like, if you both grew up in the 70s and you both went to Catholic school, or it's really, really interesting why we consider the things to be erotic that we consider to be erotic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, so in general, do you feel like polyamory or, you know, swinging could be an asset to a relationship because of that passion, and it could ignite some things?
I personally, this is an interesting subject. I'll probably get lambasted for it on your show. I'm not in favor of polyamory. I think one relationship is complicated enough.
Uh-huh.
I think it really just, if you want to have real intimacy, grow with one person and learn with them. I just haven't seen it work. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you have to have some kind of rules. And the rules that I would have, like, for me, if I were going to do that, if I had a wife and she said, hey, let's open up this marriage, for me, I think the best situation would be a don't ask, don't tell policy. Like, keep it secret. Mm-hmm. I don't want to know who you're fucking, really, because it's just going to ruin my mm-hmm. own, you know, mental life.
Yeah.
So if you need to do that, then that's on you.
Right.
And so, but when the new polyamory right now, it's like, oh, you know, you come home, you're like, oh, I fucked this person today, I fucked that person, and we'll let's all have dinner tomorrow night, and maybe we'll do some MDMA and we'll all sleep together. And, you know, mm-hmm. like, I guess if it's working for people, that's cool. I'm not against it. I'm not against any type of situation that's loving.
Sure.
All I know is that psychologically, you know, human beings are jealous. Human beings have mm-hmm. foibles. Human beings get pissed off at little things. So, like, as I said, one person in your life in an intimate situation is confusing mm-hmm. enough.
Uh-huh.
You know, two or three people, I think that you're opening up I'm sure it's wonderful and titillating and exciting at first, but I've never seen it really end well.
Uh-huh.
Well, in the 70s and such, when that was really popular, swinging and such, I think most of those marriages ended up in divorce.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I remember my parents had a couple of friends who were really into it. They actually made it together into their 90s. I don't know kind of how they did it, but I think a lot of other people around were
amazing.
Really, yeah, mm-hmm. it can be devastating. You think that it's going to be okay, mm-hmm. right? Get excited about it, but
sure.
excitement
right.
doesn't necessarily take over the other parts of your brain that want security and
sure.
comfort and loyalty and all those
right.
other things. And so it can be, yeah, we had a guest on, remember
yes.
Dr. Beth Leadham? I don't know if you've heard of her, Ira, but she's a leading psychologist in the world of
polyamory
and sex and stuff. She said herself as well that it takes so much uh-huh. processing, communication, health and well-being in your relationship. And when you really think about it, if you have really strong health and well-being in your relationship, you're probably less likely to be all interested in that anyway. So it's kind of a catch-22.
I don't know. I think it could possibly work.
I
go ahead. No problem.
There's a wonderful video on the internet. It's called Romanticism. It's by Alain de Botton, and it's at the Sydney Opera House. And he says, similar to what I say in the book and the Denis de Rougemont and the Esther Perel stuff, he says basically when you're married, you know, you have a choice. You can, you know, be married and know that you're going to be bored because, as I said, how can you desire what you already have? Or you can be single and have, like, some thrilling times, but it's probably going to be once or twice a year. It's not going to be, as you grow older, it's harder and harder.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you make that choice between security, as you were saying, and excitement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically, you know, you can do it very rationally, and it's just very, very difficult to have both.
But Kelly, you do have a little bit of, like, interest in this
yes.
whole realm, but I wonder
yeah.
if you would, if David were more of a womanizer.
Right.
You know, it's so a good point. Solidly into you that you're the one who has a little bit of the wanderlust like and the like all one. That. But you like are so secure with him that I think that you have the permission internally, because I don't think he's probably ever made you feel jealous.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. It is true. Like, if I had somebody who had that different eye, would I feel differently? I think it also depends on your relationship. I think if you really have that security in general, I don't know. I'm open to the possibility. Yeah. But, I mean, but it is true. But I think, because that's what I'm saying, like, is it possible to have both? To have that security, to have that intimacy, but then also, you know, have that fun, but then bring it back and have that communication around it. I don't know.
I had that. I did try that once in a relationship. It did not work out well.
But was that the person for you anyway?
I won't say names.
Right. No, but look, I mean, you know, I've had some experiences in college too, where it's like, but I knew that the guy ultimately wasn't, you know, going to be marriage material. So... I don't know. This is fascinating.
You and I.
Could talk about this for Ira.
No, but it is. It's a great subject. And again, it's not like we don't go on air and say that's wrong or that's bad in any way. Totally.
Sure.
If it can work for you, that's awesome. But I just have some doubts myself about the possibility of that lasting long term. I think some people can try it and then they could say, it's not really not for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Sure.
Like, we tried it, not too much damage, done.
Right.
So we can carry forward. But it is better than people having affairs and being dishonest.
Well, that's exactly. That is a good way to look at it, that you can have that excitement, but it's honest and it's open rather than secretive and feeling betrayed. You might get jealous, but I think it might be different.
Ira, let's shift gears a little bit. I'd love to talk to you a little bit about how to avoid being a professional child, which is one of the chapters in your book. Mm-hmm. Can you say more about that?
Well, sure. My whole thing is that language creates reality. So if we don't have language for it, basically my understanding is we can't think these things. So language is essentially a cage. It's a trap, and it fools us into thinking we can think infinite things. But really, any studies that you read will tell you that most of our thoughts are redundant and that our minds have a negativity bias. So the theory in the book is that we were all traumatized as children, just what we consider to be normal, going to school, you know, when you put a baby down for the first time and it doesn't understand that you're coming back in 8 hours. All these things are very traumatizing. And what your mind does is, particularly like when you're 7 or 8 years old, you're in the schoolyard, something humiliating happens, and your mind says, wow, that was really humiliating. I am never going to let that happen again. Mm-hmm. I'm going to lift weights. I'm going to be the smartest person. I'm going to speak well. I'm going to go to an Ivy League school. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And basically your whole life is, you know, you have this way of being in this world, which is just this shell or defense mechanism. And what I'm arguing is that's inauthentic, you know. And so what we have to do is at a certain point in time, decide who we want to be and the lives we want to have, and have personal integrity to toe the line, to always follow that. And, you know, that's why I start the book with the Andre Gide quote, which is, it is better to be hated for what you are than to be loved for what you are not. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is that as a child, we develop our false selves or facades in order to survive our childhood and try to get our emotional and psychological needs met. And we should be really happy because whatever tools we developed as children, they worked. But now what those tools are probably hindering us from showing up authentically and being vulnerable. You know, if you were the sarcastic guy in high school, like I was, it probably got you a good 10 years worth of laughs. And then at some point in time, you offended somebody and then you're just like, wow, like that way of being in the world, which was so successful when I was a teenager, like now I'm an asshole. Mm-hmm. And you have to pivot, you have to shift. And so, you know, like that's what I'm saying that this book should do. We have to understand how we've become inauthentic. And then, you know, if you understand that language creates reality, then you are your word. You know, my word is my bond. If I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. If I say I'm going to show up for somebody, I'm going to do it. And because that's how you have trust in reality. Because if language creates all your relationships, then you need to really, you know, you can't not honor your word, because then everyone else will just lie to you too. So for me, not being a professional child means deciding who you want to be and having personal integrity and being able to show up in a loving and compassionate way for other people and overcome all those fears, expectations, resentments, and prejudices that you developed in your childhood.
This is absolutely fascinating. Wonderful. And as you're speaking, I was thinking about my brother who was very, very skinny and in ninth grade got his head flushed down a toilet.
Oh my gosh.
And ever
well,
since
obviously
then.
Obviously, it wasn't awful. All the way down the toilet because his head is still on his shoulders.
<He's Yes. fine. laughs>
Oh
but
my gosh.
After that, he became a serious bodybuilder.
Wow.
And to this day, you know, he's 40 something. He is enormous. He is huge and he's a bodybuilder. And I always felt like that's exactly it. It's like here he is and he was, you know, so humiliated and basically said, like, that's it. I'm never going to be the skinny kid who, you know, people are going to take advantage of me. And so it's really funny that the first example you gave was like lifting weights and, you know, after. And yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. And so recognizing that.
But I think we all do this in some ways. If you look back at your way of being and there's a lot of things that you can trace. Adler believed it was compensations, like we were compensating in some ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really what I say is we become what we love and we become what we hate. And both are inauthentic, meaning that if your primary caregivers were one way, you imitated them because you wanted them to give them approval, acceptance, and love. But then when you individuate, and this is a whole other chapter in the book, during the individuation process, what you do is the opposite of them, because what you're saying is, hey, you can't tell me what to do. You know, I'm 18 years old. Even if you pay my college dorm room rent, I'm going to go get a tattoo, you know? And so it's these conflicting influences of wanting to be loved and also wanting to be your own separate self.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, complicated.
So complicated and deep. I love it. Wow.
It's so valuable, though, when people do take on the work of really moving past your childhood and putting it in its place and being able, it's so freeing, you know, you can thrive. You can be excited about new prospects in life and not have to be so fixated based on what those role models and experiences were. So good job, Ira, for
pointing
making this user-friendly.
I start the last chapter by a quote from Cheryl Strayed's book, Wild, because, you know, she was a heroin addict and a prostitute and all these things. And I don't know if you want to read that part aloud, but she says, you know, what if heroin taught me something? What if I wanted to fuck all those men or I had to or something? Like, what if everything that went into making me today, you know, wasn't a bad thing because I'm okay right now. So I just love that. And then I quote also Nietzsche where he says, on this perfect day when everything is ripening and not only the grapes are becoming brown, a ray of sunshine has fallen on my life. I look behind me. I look before me. Never have I seen so many and such good things together. Not in vain have I buried my 44th year today. I had the right to bury it. How could I not be grateful for the whole of my life? So instead of like trying to cherry pick those bad things that happened out of your life, say, oh, I'd be much happier if I had won the lottery, if I'd gone to Yale, if my father hadn't done this, if my dog hadn't died, whatever it is. Instead of saying, no, you know, there's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. So choose to think that your life happened the way it was supposed to happen rather than fighting against things you can't change, because that just causes resentment and it causes your own suffering. When you're trying to, you know, I make a joke in the book. I say, if you came home today and saw one of your kids sitting on the couch trying to shove a square peg into a round hole, you would stop them. And yet this is what your mind does all day long.
There is something so sad for me when I hear people say, oh, I wish I would have or I should have, and living in that regret, begetting more regret, and that vicious cycle. And it's like I want to like shake them and go, you're not going to get anywhere good by doing that.
You're not
going to
get anywhere good by doing that.
You just won't. And it's just, it's heartbreaking. And yet and so many people do that.
I'm hearing
I have reverberation.
Like a feedback loop here.
I'm echoing because my voice likes the sound of
my
voice.
No, I think your words are just
Are we on now?
Yeah.
Yes, we are.
Your words were so powerful. It just
they echoed.
It had
right
to
back.
Repeat again. It's like a boomerang. But no, you're 100% right. And I agree with your thinking, Ira. It's like, right, you can go with it two ways. You can look at it like, okay, yeah, you know, why didn't I do that? Or no, this is happening for a reason. And it's like, it's so much more freeing when you're thinking like, well, this happened on purpose and it taught me this and things like that. It's just, it's a better way to live.
And honoring choices right. that we make.
Well, I mean, there's a beautiful quote by Eckhart Tolle. He says, you either accept your life or change it. Any other position is insane. So I really like that definition of insanity. Like if you're complaining, if you're like, if I were complaining today, like, you know, I'd be happy if I were 7 feet tall and could play basketball. You would look at me like, well, you're not 7 feet tall. You're 51 years old. It's highly unlikely that you're going to grow another foot. So you probably just accept being 6 feet tall and not have resentment for not being 7 feet tall. And, you know, because, mm-hmm. but that's what we do all day long. You know, our mind is like, oh, I should have done this. I should have done that, blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah. And all these hypothetical situations are causing our own misery.
Mm. I know so many people, tell me if you've encountered this too, who almost have a compulsion to cause themselves to feel guilty or regret as if that makes them a better person. Like somehow they perceive themselves as cold-hearted or insensitive or something if they just let go of that stuff and just really truly accept what is, like as if they're too nonchalant. Or I've had right. some
like
people,
they have to punish themselves,
they have to punish yeah. themselves, otherwise they're gonna go to hell or right. they're, you know, right. not gonna be seen as a noble person. It's like, well, that is just bullshit.
Mm-hmm. For me, it's all about balance, really. I mean, like, on the one hand, you know, as you were saying in the beginning, there, if you're too ego-oriented, you're going to come off narcissistic. And then if you don't have a strong enough ego, you'll come off as self-deprecating, and it might be just a little too much. You know, you might end up cutting. You might end up doing some self-harm. So, like, it's all about balance and having, like, a realistic understanding of reality and then being able to articulate that in a loving manner. It's fascinating for me because I spent my 20s, in, as I said, in Paris and New York, and I still go to cafes and I listen to the things that people talk about. So Carolyn Mace has this whole thing about how we're basically tribal, as human beings are tribal creatures, and we want to find our tribe. Like when you meet someone for the first time, you're talking about things to figure out if you can trust them. Are you going to have to run from them? Are they going to try and, kill you, things like that. And for me, it's always fascinating because in our society, a lot of those things have to do with status. And I quote David Brooks' book, which is called Bogos in Paradise, from 16 or 17 years ago. And, the conversations people have, like, I vacationed in St. Bart's for Christmas. And then the next person would be like, oh, yeah, we used to go to St. Bart's. Now we go to Antilles. And so, like, they're basically searching for their tribe. And yet there's still like this bizarre ego one-upmanship, like, oh, Antilles is much cooler than St. Bart's. We don't go there anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's really fascinating to me to like sit in the cafes where I sit and listen to the things that people talk about. Because on the one hand, they want to be loved. They're trying to connect. And on the other hand, they're talking about fucking bullshit.
So true.
Yes, that is fucking bullshit. Your turn, Kelly.
So true. It is so true.
It is so well, true. It is so true.
Well, we know you have to end pretty soon. So is there anything else that you want to touch upon in the last 2 minutes that we haven't covered?
Well, for me, the only panacea is authenticity. And so I break that down in the book into attachment, atonement, attunement, presence, and congruence. So attachment is just being aware of your primary attachment dynamic, which also correlates to your relationship with money. You know, do you trust in the universe? Is the universe an abundant place, or do you have to hoard things? And then atonement is really at one mint, realizing your inner oneness, and that's a spiritual thing, but your mind creates all these resentments, so you have to release those resentments, and the way you do that is by forgiveness. And there's a beautiful quote in the book, I quote Lily Tomlin, who says, forgiveness means giving up all hope of having a better past. Mm-hmm. So, it's in everyone's best interest to just forgive. The third thing is attunement, and I say in the book, mirror neurons do not fire via text message. We delude ourselves into thinking that we're connecting with other people through all the social media, but what we really need is hugs. We really need to have coffee, throw a frisbee, take a walk. We need a hug. The fourth component of authenticity is presence, which is not letting your mind drag you into the past or drag you into the future. The past is dead and gone. It doesn't exist. The future doesn't yet exist. So for me, the tools are yoga and meditation. And then the last part is the congruence, deciding who you want to be. You know, if you tap into your higher self, who you should be. And then, you know, you just have to have the right tools to be that person. So for me, if you want to lead a happy life, if you want to keep yourself at the high end of your happiness spectrum, be as authentic as possible with people. And the things that I think make people authentic are attachment, atonement, attunement, presence, and congruence.
Oh, I love that. I love it. So great.
AAA PC.
Oh my God, I love that. Ira, you are such a fantastic person and so articulate, and just I met Ira the other day. She's got this warm, lovely Zen energy. So thank you so much.
Thank you
where
so
can
much.
We, where can people find your book and the DVDs and all that good stuff?
Everything is on iraisrael.com. There's 5 DVDs on Amazon Prime. I teach at the Esalen Institute. We have 70 people. There's 2 spots left for February, and then I do a week in the fall. I'm actually at Black Dog Yoga in the Valley this weekend. And then, just contact me through the website. There's all of my classes, the books. There's free videos of prior classes. And I'm here to answer any questions. You know, it's an honor to be on your show with you and to chat with you. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, I can't wait to meet you in person. You've been a delight. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Ira.
Thanks. Thank you, guys. I'll talk to you later. Thank you again.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Excellent.
So fascinating.
Yeah, so much fun. Yeah, that was so conversational. I love
me too. I love those philosophical conversations that you feel like you're, like, back in college smoking pot, like, you know.
Yeah,
around
we all had something to say.
Yeah, exactly.
Great, great book. Yeah, so in case you missed that, we were talking with Ira Israel, author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult. And it kind of like a really different content than what you would expect in that book.
That's what I thought too.
You know,
yes.
Like really just a whole different component of the things to look at and all that. Mm-hmm. And I just love it. So definitely do that. All right. So next week we have, Is it Appel?
I think it's Appel. Yeah.
Appel. Like a lapel, but an Appel.
But we'll have to find
we'll
out
have
for
to
sure.
Ask her, yes. The telomere effect. Do you
yes.
have any idea
yes.
What that
that's
is?
Anti-aging. Very interesting. Stress and anti-aging. So maybe she'll give us the Fountain of Youth.
Well, you're going to need it. You're turning 40 this week.
Zip it.
Sorry.
No, I'm totally
I'm
cool
teasing.
About it.
It's really 30.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got to get over this.
No, I'm all good.
It's not old.
No, I know. It's all good.
And
really.
Besides, there's nothing worse than complaining about turning 40 when you're talking to somebody who's over 50.
It's true.
That's when somebody like me wants to slap you.
Exactly.
In the face,
okay? I know. I get it.
It's like me talking that I'm old next to somebody who's 70.
Right. Exactly.
Right? Okay.
But you know, here's the good news. I feel better emotionally and physically now than I ever have in the past.
Well, yeah, because so, you each year, each day, each moment, you acquire new wisdom and new mm-hmm. appreciation for things, and you know, you make people are more attracted to you as you get older, actually, because you're just a more rich and wholesome person
and confident, secure,
yes,
and all
that. Those good
yeah,
things.
Yeah, makes sense.
So you have fewer people who want to slap you across the face.
Exactly.
Kidding. Any exciting things coming up this week?
What am I doing? David's cousin's coming in, so that'll be fun. So we'll hang out with her. I had my cousin a couple weeks ago.
See, so, every time I hear that you have guests coming in, I think, you really want guests because they'll take your kids off your
but
hands.
But they never do.
They never do?
They never do.
I got to give your guests training.
Oh, my, please. I'm down for it 100%. But I do like hosting and like having people there and, you know, feeling that. So it should be really fun.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yay.
What about you? Anything exciting?
I don't, you know, it just comes as it comes.
Good.
You know, sort of just take things as they yes. show up. Have a couple of plans with some friends over the weekend, working on Saturday, you know, just mm-hmm. trying to just enjoy every moment. It's really my mission this
That's
year.
That's so nice.
And every year forward. Just
right.
to really just take a lot of deep breaths and uh-huh. just say, huh, this is what this moment is bringing to me right now.
Yeah.
And just like what he said, accept it, or if I don't like it, change
I
it.
I love that quote. Mm-hmm. I wrote it down. I mm-hmm. absolutely love that because it's so true, because in between, it's like there's nothing.
Mm-hmm. I learned that in the Gestalt world, the paradox of change. The only way to make change is to accept what mm-hmm. is.
It's true.
Right? If we don't want to accept what it is, what the hell are we changing?
Yes.
We don't even know what direction we're going in.
So true.
Yeah. All right. Great show. Good
awesome.
To see you, sweetie.
You too.
Love you all. Thank you so
Bye-bye.
Much for listening.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.